introduce Doctor or Professor? Doctor. Dr. Robert C. Helling from the University of Munich. And please give him a big hand for his presentation here on one of the most confusing topics that I ever had to read about when I was doing physics, which is supersymmetry. Thank you very much, Dr. Helling.
Okay, thank you for coming to this prime time talk on day two. yes, my name is Robert Helling. I'm a physicist at Munich University, and this talk is by request of a local brewer hacker that asked me to talk about supersymmetry. So who knows these people? Just to get an idea. I'm over 40. Who else is over 40? So in particular, this lady. You all know her, but who recognizes her? It's Madonna, yes. It's an icon 80s movie picture. Okay, so what is supersymmetry? We are talking about particle physics, and supersymmetry, or SUSY in short, is a symmetry that predicts that for every known species of particles, there is a new particle, and not a single one of them has ever been observed. So, why bother? And I will probably spend 45 minutes to explain why bother. So I want to explain why my colleagues have come up with this idea of supersymmetry, because it solves some of the big outstanding problems in particle physics and theoretical high energy physics in general. So, but I have to explain a couple of things. So a brief introduction of, first, the known players, that is the standard model of particle physics that consists of metaparticles, namely the leptons. They all have spin 1/2. This s is the spin. That's the angular momentum, the intrinsic angular momentum of the particle. Most well known of these particles is the electron, here depicted as E. And there are also neutrinos. You might have heard about those because there were some rumors that they could travel faster than light. That turned out to be a problematic cable. But these two. So this one is everyday physics and chemistry. This one is very light. They have heavy, the electron has heavier partners, and there are also neutrinos for these partners called, this is the muon, this is the tauon. And then, in addition, so these guys make up the hull of an atom, and the core, or the nucleus of an atom, is made up out of quarks and neutrons, and those consist out of quarks, namely of these up and down quarks, but they're form more types of quarks called charm, strange, bottom, and top. And then there are four forces in the universe. One is gravity, that doesn't matter for elementary particles. The others are mediated by particles again. Those have spin one, and the most well known is the gamma particle or the photon that's responsible for electromagnetism. But there's also the W and the Z vector boson that mediates the weak interaction that is responsible for beta decay. And there are gluons that actually keep these quarks together in the nucleus. And then, since this year, we know that there is actually another particle of spin zero, and that's called the Higgs boson. And this year, the Nobel Prize was given for the prediction of this particle. So that is the standard model. These are the particles that we have all by now seen, and they fit well into this model called the standard model. Now comes supersymmetry, and for each and every one of those, there's a new partner. So now we're talking about the minimally supersymmetric standard model. That minimally refers to we're adding as little as possible. So for these s equals 1/2 particles, we add s equals 0 particles called the sleptons. You get their names by adding an s. So that's the selectron, that's the smion, and that's the stau, as well as squarks. And then to these force particles, there are fermions with s equals 1/2 called the photino for the photon. the weenos and the xenos for the W and the Z. You see that you were adding an eno and a glue eno, or actually several one, for the gluons, plus a Higgs eno. And to make things internally consistent, this doesn't quite work. We have to add another pair of Higgs and Higgs eno to make things work. So this is the minimally supersymmetric standard model, and I will be talking mostly about this setup of elementary particles. These discovered, these hypothetical. And then there's an important principle in quantum physics that particles are fields. So there's this is the electromagnetic field, but it's described by a photon particle. And the fields are, again, particles. So I will, in the rest of the talk, use this synonymously. OK, so I claimed there are open problems that are solved by assuming supersymmetry is a symmetry of nature. And I have five of them listed here. The first is actually very close to my heart when I'm actually doing research. That's the mathematics of quantum field theory. But unfortunately, I won't talk about this. The next one, this will take quite a while to explain, it's called naturalness. Susie provides a solution to the naturalness problem. And to explain this, I have to go on a small detour. I have to explain how we theoretical physicists in the 21st century view these force fields, so in particular the electromagnetic field. So this is how everybody learns what electromagnetism is. You have a van der Waals generator, and that makes your hair go up. And you have charges and force fields. And this is electromagnetism 101. But I want, I ask you to believe me that there is a completely different point of view that's actually talking about the same thing than electric and magnetic fields. And that goes like this. So let's assume, so this is space. This is Hamburg CCH, Dammtorbahnhof, Planck und Blohm. And at each point in space, there's a virtual or internal plane attached to each point in space. So for 5 by 5, my pointer is dying, but for 5 by 5 points, I've drawn these spheres. Oh, and not spheres. Actually, these are whole planes. And they have a rotational symmetry. I can rotate the plane around the origin. So let's do that. So now I hope everybody can see that these guys are rotating around the origin. Rotating? Yeah, you get it. Get an idea. At least the people in the front row. But the important thing is, so now they're all rotating in the same way. They're all rotating in parallel. But you can rotate them independently. So now this starts, then the others come on. So you see each one is rotating separately from the others. So this movie that you see here is actually a depiction of an electromagnetic wave traveling here from, what's this, southwest to northeast. So here it goes again. OK? And I claim, and I have to ask you to believe this, I cannot explain this further, that electromagnetism is nothing but the description of these rotations. So if I have a description of these rotations, I'm talking in an equivalent way about electromagnetism. This is actually a representation of Maxwell's equations, if you happen to know what those are out there. So in particular, there's somewhere in these rotations, there's the Coulomb law that describes the force between two charges. But I'm claiming this contains all the information about the electromagnetism, how these planes rotate. OK, so and the point is not only electromagnetism is about of this type. So electromagnetism is a rotation of a plane. Here you see the plane rotating. But also the weak force, remember, beta decay, W and Z bosons. This is also about rotations. But this force is not about rotations of a plane. This is about rotations in a three-dimensional space, so if you like, of a sphere. So this sphere here is rotating at about different axes. And that's encoding the weak force. So weak force. So technically, it's not this group. That rotation group is SU2. There's also the strong force that is about rotations in a complex three-dimensional space, and I don't have a better picture of this than hyperspace. But the principle, the mathematics is the same, it's just high dimensional. Okay, so that is, I claim, these are all the forces in the universe, maybe except gravity, are just rotations of some sort of internal spaces that are attached to each point in space. Okay, these are the forces. Now comes the Higgs effect. So I told you, Higgs particle, Nobel Prize 2013. I explain you what the Higgs effect is. Very simple. In addition to the plane, there's a little blue ball in the plane. And the Higgs field just tells you where in the plane the ball is. So right now it's in the origin, right? But I can move, in principle, I can move the ball around to any other point in the plane. And the notion where the ball is, that is the Higgs field, in the same spirit as the rotation of the plane is electromagnetism. And now we add something to this plane. We add a potential energy, so kind of landscape. So let's turn that on. So this now looks a bit like the bottom of a champagne bottle. So I've added some potential energy, but this is still rotationally symmetric. So now rotational symmetry is still intact. Now you have these champagne bottles with the blue ball in the origin, and this thing is still rotationally symmetric. The wave goes through Hamburg. Hello? Okay, but of course the ball at the tip of the champagne bottle is not the minimal energy configuration. The ball wants to be further down. You can gain energy by bringing the ball down. So let's do that. Whoop. Now you see the ball's at the bottom. So, and of course, there's more than one possibility to put the ball at the bottom. There's a whole ring of possible places where the ball can lie in a minimal energy configuration. And each one of them, each choice for position of the ball on the bottom breaks the rotational symmetry. Wherever I place the ball, the symmetry is broken. So now if I rotate these planes with the ball, as this happens here, I have to drag the ball around. And that costs energy. And this energy, this turns out to be the mass that is given. So the symmetry is broken, and this is how mass is created. The mass is actually the energy it costs to drag the ball around when the electromagnetic wave goes through this configuration with the broken symmetry. And that is the Higgs effect. This is how the Higgs effect gives mass to elementary particles. And so, okay. So when I said this happens in electromagnetism, this is actually not true. I lied to you. In electromagnetism, the symmetry is not broken, and the photon remains massless. That's good, because otherwise it couldn't travel long distance. You couldn't see me if the photon were massive. It would decay before it reaches. The photon that comes from me or from the screen would decay and would not be there if it would be massive. But it's massless, so you can see the screen. But the Higgs effect takes place for the weak interaction. Remember, that was the one with the rotating ball. But then with the ball, I couldn't draw the potential. So I chose to use this representation. But it happens for the weak interaction. And this Higgs effect makes these Z and W bosons that mediate this force. It gives them a mass of roughly 100 gigaelectron volts. Gigaelectron volts, or electron volts, is the energy unit that particle physicists use. That's very convenient. So this is an important number. Remember this, 100 GeV. Okay, and this mass corresponds to the distance that the ball has from the center. So that's kind of the radius of the motion of the ball that I have to drag around. The further it's out there, the more difficult it gets to drag the ball around. Okay, so that was the Higgs effect and gauge interactions. So such interactions are called gauge interactions. German speakers call them Eichwechselwirkung. Okay, so now for something completely different. That was my first explanation. This is how electromagnetism and its friends work. Now comes a different concept that's called renormalization. So now I'm back to the old picture. This is supposed to be an electron, and this is supposed to be the antiparticle of an electron, a positron. This is just like the electron just with positive charge instead of negative charge. This has nothing to do with the superpartners. This is all standard model physics. And the wiggly lines I've drawn here is the Coulomb field. That's the electromagnetic field that drags this violet ball towards the red ball. And everybody learned in school that this force this force of attraction between the balls is proportional to the charge of the electron, and it scales inversely with the square of the distance. That's Coulomb's law. Everybody should have learned this in high school at some point, hopefully. Okay? Coulomb's law. This everybody knows. Okay, so now this picture, that this was classical physics. This is the physics you learn in school. But the world is a quantum world and is more complicated. The upshot of quantum mechanics is that the charge of the electron actually depends on the distance at which you look at it. And this comes about as follows. So quantum mechanics says the vacuum is not empty. Not a matter bottle falling down. Okay, you fell asleep, no problem. Okay. Everything okay? Okay, back to quantum physics. Quantum physics says the vacuum is full of virtual pairs of particles and their antiparticles. They pop out of nothing and annihilate again. So I've drawn a couple of those here. You see the original electron, the original positron, but there are a couple of other electron-positron pairs that have popped out of the vacuum for a split second. But these particles are also charged the red one is positive, and the purple one is negative, the other way around. Red, negative, purple, positive. And they also see the electromagnetic field of this electron. So the purple one likes to go towards the red ball, and the red ball likes to go away from it. So they align a little bit in this field. You see that the purple one's always closer to the red ball in the virtual positron-electron pair than the electron. So that causes something like a polarization of the vacuum, and that yields a shielding effect. So now this positron that was supposed to see the electric field of this electron not only sees the electric field of this electron that I've drawn here, but it sees also the electric field of all these other virtual particles. And because they are aligned in the original field, it turns out the field that this particle sees is actually a little bit weaker because it's shielded by these other pairs. And this shielding effect is stronger the stronger the first field is, because stronger because you're closer. So when you're closer, then the alignment is even stronger and the shielding effect is even stronger. And you can subsume this by saying, actually, so I total all these, the charge and the shielding, into a new charge called the renormalized charge. And that is then a charge that depends on the distance r. So now the electric field E is proportional, well, at distance r, is proportional to the charge corresponding to the particular distance here. R is the distance from here to here, divided by r squared. That's the upshot of renormalization. That's a quantum version of the Coulomb law. So now how does Q of r look like? So that's called running couplings, because the charge is one example of coupling. And it's running because it depends now on the distance. And a similar effect applies not only to the charge of particles, but also for other properties of the particles, for example, of the mass. Also, the mass of a particle, like 511 keV for an electron, that's not the full truth. That depends on the distance. The distance at which I measure the mass. And for almost all properties, this dependence Q of r is logarithmic. So there is a coefficient called beta, the so-called beta function, times the logarithm of r. So logarithm, as you know, is a function that grows very slowly with r. And this coefficient beta depends on particular types of the particles that are participating in this shielding. So you have to you can calculate this, actually, and it depends on all the types of particles that can pop up from the vacuum. And also, another property of a particle is the shape. Remember the champagne bottle? The shape of the potential. And that happens to depend not logarithmically, like the charge or the mass, but it depends quadratically on the distance. So it goes more like some coefficient times r squared. And r squared is a function that is much more sensitive to r than the logarithm. You change r a little bit, logarithm stays mostly the same. You change r a little bit, but the square of that changes actually quite a bit. So, and because the mass of the W and Z bosons, remember, they came from the ball that was not in the center, but somewhere in this potential. So the result is that the mass of these particles is very sensitive to the distance at which I measure them. And for particle physics units, 100 GeV is actually quite a small mass. And if it were, in fact, quadratically sensitive to the distance, it's very unnatural to be so small. Based on order of magnitude estimates, you would actually expect it to be 17 orders of magnitude bigger. So the natural size would be more the Planck size, Planck scale of 10 to the 19 GeV, rather than the 10 to the 2 GeV that it actually is. There's a question. The point is, it cannot be quadratic, because it would be at just one distance, and if you change this a little bit, it would be completely different. And that's not what we observe. So this smallness of this mass is not natural. We would expect it to be much, much bigger based on this type of argument. So we have to explain why nature can maintain the small mass of 100 GeV. And that's the naturalness problem. Explain how the mass can be 100 GeV small. And supersymmetry provides a solution to this problem. How does it work? Well, it works because the coefficient, remember, there was this alpha coefficient. There was this number in front that says what is the coefficient of this r squared? In supersymmetric theories, the original standard model particles and their superpartners contribute exactly the same amount, but with opposite signs, to this alpha. So if I'm not only electrons and positrons popping out of the vacuum, but as well selectrons and spositrons, their effect cancels, and there's a zero in front of this r squared. So this quadratic running of the mass of the W and Z bosons goes away for exactly supersymmetric theories, because in supersymmetry, the effect of the different types cancel. So that would be an explanation of the naturalness and, well, of the smallness of the size, and the naturalness would be saved if nature would have, in addition to electrons and positrons, their superpartners. Well, that would be too nice to be true, because supersymmetry predicts that besides the spin, all the other properties of the partner particles, so the selectrons for the electrons, are actually the same. So in particular, it would predict that the selectron also has the same mass as the electron, 511 keV. But of course, I told you, nobody has seen a supersymmetric partner particle. In particular, we would have known if there were a boson. So that could be a partner particle at 512, sorry, I'm always saying 511. No, it's 511, this 2 is wrong. So if there would be another particle with the same mass as the electron, I mean, we produce electrons all the time, and we've never produced any of these partner particles. So that cannot be true. I mean, supersymmetry that predicts the partner particles have the same mass must be wrong. And the way out is, there's also a Higgs effect. So the symmetry breaking effect, remember the ball rolling away from the center, that breaks supersymmetry. So supersymmetry is also a broken symmetry, like this rotational symmetry in nature. But we have to do this in a way to preserve this naturalness that the supersymmetry brings. So how does that work? So there's some way to break SUSY, like with the ball. And then the superpartners of all the known particles can have larger mass than the known particles. And then the quadratic running is back, because the canceling is not exact anymore. but only up to about the mass of the superpartner. So up from that mass on, there are again particles and superpartners, and then the cancellation kicks in again. Is that clear? So for masses below the mass of the superpartners are invisible, and there is quadratic running. But for higher energies, or for higher masses, where the superpartners are, the cancellation effectively works again. So we would expect that the running happens, there is quadratic running, but only up to the mass of the superpartners. And that means, since the mass that we observe of the W and Z bosons is 100 GeV, if this explanation of naturalness works, then this would suggest that the superpartners also have masses in this range of 100 GeV. OK, that was the point with the naturalness. That is actually the strongest point for supersymmetry. There's another point called unification of gauge interactions. So I explained what gauge interactions are. Gauge interactions are these things with rotations. And I told you there are three in nature. There's the electromagnetic force, which is one. There's the weak force, and there's the strong force. And we measured their values. Well, we measured how strong, actually what we measure is the electric charge, and that's a measure of how strong the electromagnetic field is. And so this is actually a measure of the distance here. So we are here at long distances away. We measured the values of the three charges. And then here, here, and here. And I told you we can compute the coefficient of this logarithmic running, this beta. And so we can extrapolate from our distance scale to other distance scales. Or here, so I told you this is log of q. Well, this is effectively a measure of the distance scale, a logarithm of the distance. So this gives you straight lines. And you see that they almost meet in a point. Well, not quite, right? The intersection of the three lines is pretty close, but it's not in one point. So pretty close, already quite surprising. If you have three general straight lines, their interactions are all over the place. But here, they almost meet at the same point. But with supersymmetry, the coefficient is a little bit different because the supersymmetric partners contribute. With supersymmetry, these lines happen to meet all in the same point. So at some distance scale or at some energy scale, 10 to the 16 in this graph, all the charges happen to be the same, although at our distance scales, they're very different. So how can this be? So the idea is that actually these are not three different forces, but that this is a single force that comes about from a rotation in an even higher dimensional space than the hyperspace I was showing with Han and Schumacher. Because this braking mechanism, so now here I've tried to draw the braking. So here is the blue ball, but now in the sphere. And if the blue ball sits here, then a rotation of the ball around the axis that goes through this point is still a symmetry of this configuration. So the original ball had rotations about three axes as a symmetry. But after I placed the ball here, there's still one axis where the symmetry remains, and the rotation about the two other axes are broken. So by placing the ball here, I do not completely remove the symmetry, but I make it a smaller symmetry. Only rotation about one axis rather than three axes is a rotation of this. So the idea is, if I go back, so also here is the Higgs effect. So this is the mass of this additional Higgs particle. And then there are three independent remaining symmetries that, after this point, become one big rotation group. Well, this rotation group is actually rotation in a 10-dimensional space. Again, I cannot draw this. But that is the idea. So this is how this comes about, that the three lines meet in one point. They all come from the same symmetry, higher symmetry. But this is not the only indication of this higher symmetry. Actually, there are more. So this diagram is called a weight diagram. I'm going to explain this. Says all the particles that we know fit nicely into groups of particles that transform according to this bigger symmetry. So many people believe that this symmetry is actually a symmetry of nature. at high energies where the breaking of the symmetry is undone. And there are also the fact that the neutrinos have masses and that their masses are roughly in the right range is also an indication that this thing is going on. And I showed you this unification. The meeting of the three lines in one point happens only with the supersymmetry. Without supersymmetry, it does not happen. It's ruled out by a current observation. So if you want this, you need supersymmetry. The next open problem that is solved by Suzy comes from a completely different angle of physics. So far, I've talked about particle physics. Now let's talk about astrophysics. This is a galaxy. This is a picture from Hubble Space Telescope. And so as you know, the galaxy is actually a disk. And we're viewing this disk from almost from the side here. This one. So this disk is rotating around an axis that is almost vertically in this picture. And now what you can do by using the Doppler effect, you can measure the rotation velocity of this disk. Because you know, when the ambulance comes towards you, the sound is higher in pitch than when it goes away from you. Everybody knows the effect called Doppler effect that also happens for light. And from observing the frequency, or if you like, the color of the light of the stars here, you can determine the velocity at which these stars are coming towards us or moving away. So if this galaxy rotates, say, this way, then the stars here are coming towards us, and the stars here are moving away from us. And this can be measured. Right? So people observe this for many, many galaxies. And the other thing you can do is you can just look at the picture and kind of count how many stars are in this galaxy. Well, not you, but people can. People have an idea how many stars are in this galaxy, and they also have an idea how big the stars are, because astronomers, again, from the color of the star, can determine the mass of the star. So you can actually determine the mass distribution in this galaxy from looking at how bright it is. And so that's something astronomers can do. And since the rotation is balanced, so the centrifugal force from the rotation is balancing the gravitational pull of all the other stars towards the center of the galaxy, by computing how much mass there is, you know how strong is the gravitational pull on, say, this star here. And that determines how fast it has to go around the center of the galaxy. So when I say that this disk is rotating, it doesn't mean that it's uniformly rotating. So the speed of rotation can depend on the radius. Like in the solar system, the speed at which the planets fly around the sun depends on the distance of the planets from the star. So stars orbit the center of the galaxy, and let's draw a diagram. I draw this rotation velocity v against the radius, the distance, from the center of the galaxy. And I told you, from estimating the mass in the galaxy, you can predict the velocity of the star, the velocity of the stars as a function of the radius. So that gives you a curve that roughly looks like this. And you can measure it using the Doppler effect. And what you measure looks like this. So obviously, there's something wrong with your prediction. So it turns out, this is the true thing. And this was predicted on the mass that you see. So how can this be wrong? How can you be so wrong? Well, the only solution is that you're not seeing all the mass. Actually, you need more than 5 times of the mass of the stars that you see in the galaxy to get this rotation curve. So this curve of velocities, that is almost flat, rather than decaying like this. So the conclusion is there must be more mass in this galaxy than the mass of the atoms in the stars. And further from looking at the details of this curve, you can determine what this mass, the properties of where this mass comes about. So you have to people conclude that this mass has to be in the form of heavy, stable particles, so that are only subject to gravity and the weak force, but not electrically charged or strongly interacting. Because heavy means that They are moving slowly. They are moving at non-relativistic speeds. They are moved much slower than the speed of light in this galaxy. Furthermore, they must go through the stars and everything that happens in the galaxy without interacting with them, without scattering with them, because otherwise they would also be kind of aligned with the stars, and they are not aligned with the stars. And so that determines the properties of this particle. So there has to be, and it, of course it has to be stable, because these galaxies have been around for a long, long time. And they wouldn't be there anymore if these particles that make up this additional mass would have decayed in the meantime. So there has to be a heavy particle that is stable and not interacting, having any significant interaction with the matter of the stars. And such a particle is called a WIMP, a weakly interacting massive particle. And I should say no WIMPs are amongst the known species of particles. So in the Standard Model, there is no particle that would work as a WIMP. First, some of them are not heavy enough. Like the neutrinos would be wonderful WIMPs, except that they are much too light. And the heavier particles wouldn't be kind of non-interacting with the stars. So there has to be an additional particle that makes up this dark matter in the galaxy. And it turns out supersymmetry provides exactly such a particle because of the following reason. So far I haven't told you about this, but supersymmetric particles have a property called R parity. Parity is something that can be either plus one or minus one. And it's plus one for all the known particles and minus one for all the superpartners that would have still be to be found. And that is conserved. So the product of this parity in a particle interaction has to be conserved. And that means you can only create new particles in pairs because the square, so each one would contribute a factor of minus one. So that's plus one. So this is a process that you have to read from left to right. There are two quarks interacting, giving a W boson, and that decays now into, these guys are supersymmetric partners, and it decays into two, each one having minus one as R parity. And then these decay further. So this one decays by emitting a new neutrino, that's an ordinary particle. So, and in a decay, there has to be an odd number of new particles in the product. So there's one, there's a slepton, and that again sends out an lepton, and there's also a remaining supersymmetric partner particle. So when they're created in pairs, and when they decay, if there's a supersymmetric partner particle in a decay before the decay, there has to be one after the decay. So the total number of super partners in a process always has to be an even number. And that means if I have a super partner and it decays, in the products there's always another super partner. And if I have the lightest super partner called the LSP, the lightest supersymmetric particle, it cannot decay any further because there's no mass, no energy it can decay into. And it cannot decay into only standard model particles because that would violate this parity. So that makes the lightest super partner stable. And therefore, such a LSP, a lightest supersymmetric particle, has exactly the properties that we need to explain dark matter and the rotation of galaxies. So that's another pro of supersymmetry. And finally, again, something close to my heart, I'm not going to say anything about this, we are not stuck with particles, there's also superstrings. And if you ever want to make a realistic model out of superstrings that gives you standard model particles, the only way we know to do this is also to actually create the supersymmetric version of the standard model. But I'm not going to say anything more about this. So superstrings also want supersymmetry. OK, so these five problems, out of which I try to explain three, are our reason to believe that supersymmetry is actually a good idea to have. So let's look for it. And then what we look for, there's unfortunately a problem. In particular, the breaking of the supersymmetry. Remember, we needed to break it because we need the superpartners to be heavy. There's 120 parameters. 120 numeric parameters. You should compare this to the 19 parameters that we have in the standard model. So again, there's not the standard model, but there is a 19-dimensional space of standard models. You have to choose 19 numbers. Here I've listed the ones of the standard model, so you have to choose the mass of the electron, the mass of the other particles, there are some mixing angles, blah-de-blah. In total, there are 19 numbers that you have to measure. These 19 numbers determine the standard model. Unfortunately, for supersymmetry, you need to measure 120 parameters to determine exactly which incarnation of the supersymmetric, of the minimum supersymmetric standard model you have. So if you measure something, for example, at LHC, you have to be specific. Well, first, you would have to measure these 120 parameters, or you make an assumption about the values of these parameters, and then you check whether that's realized or not. So you can turn this argument around, say there's, with 120 parameters, there's plenty of room to avoid detection. So if you don't see anything, you say, oh, maybe the parameters have different values, and you can go on. And every measurement that you make is relative to some choices for some, at least some of these parameters. So that so looking for supersymmetry is actually a hard thing because you have to determine a lot of numbers. And our best way to look for it, for supersymmetry, is at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. So here I gave you the picture that I hope you've seen many times before in the popular press. This is the collider ring. Somewhere here, this is the computing center or the control center on the CERN ground. But there, at several points in the ring, there are detectors where actually experiments happen. In particular, there are two of them here, CMS and here ATLAS, are big detectors where the two beams that are running around in the pipe here were colliding. So yesterday there was a talk about LHC that I hope explained this in much more detail than I can. So this, but for today, this is all you have to know. Two detectors called ATLAS and CMS that are different, but in principle measuring the same thing. And there's another problem with the Large Hadron Collider, and that's hadron. Hadron is a type of particle, and protons are examples of hadrons. And protons, remember, these are the things in the nucleus of an atom. These are the things that are accelerated at LHC because they're easy to accelerate, to say it in short. The problem is, remember, in my list of particles, there were no protons because they are not elementary. They consist of quarks. They consist of three quarks. And actually, because of this renormalization effect and particles popping out of the vacuum, and these energies that we're looking at, they consist actually of more or less 2,000 particles. So a proton is a cloud of 2,000 particles, including the ones that are popping out from the vacuum, that you are accelerating. And then you collide them. And when you collide two protons at LHC, you're not colliding two protons, but actually you pick from each proton, pick one of these 2,000 particles, and you collide these two particles. And all the twice 1,999, roughly, particles just fly through as bystanders. And that makes these processes, so that's a depiction of such a collision, very hard to analyze because there's a lot of garbage flying around. Also, these collisions happen. The beams have a collision energy of ATV, but the ATV is distributed amongst these twice 2,000 particles. So the collision happens only with a small fraction of these ATV. And we don't know at which fraction, because we don't know the details of the particles. So we have to look at lots of these processes, get rid of the debris, and do statistical analysis on this, and that's actually quite hard. So it's not something you turn on and you immediately see something. So that's a picture of this ATLAS detector. Here you see a person. That gives you an idea how big this thing is. This is, this is from the construction of the detector. This is the detector with the inner part of the detector removed. You look along the beam pipe here. This empty space is actually filled with detector. This is only the outer part of the detector. And here you see the beam part like this, and this is part of the detector, the muon detector. So to give you an idea how big this is, so this is a multi-story building, if you'd be there, several stories underground. And this is what this detector measures, or actually this is a simulation. What you see here, the beam pipe goes here in the middle. So some proton, one beam of protons comes from here, the other beam of proton comes from here, and here they're supposed to collide. And when they collide, they go through several shells of detectors. So in the, this innermost shell, this consists of a detector type where you can track the particles. And the next shell, there you can only see the energy that is deposited in this detector, and that's indicated by these yellow bars. And then some particles, namely the muons, make only those make it out of this inner shell of the detector and reach the outer part, and there again tracks where you can detect them. This is how one such collision looks like, and there are millions and millions of those every second. So this is what you're seeing. Now, what would supersymmetry look like? And the answer is, the smoking gun for supersymmetry is that you don't see it. In which sense? Well, I explained to you that the LSP, the lightest supersymmetric particle, doesn't interact with matter, so it's invisible to the detector. It just flies out of the detector and you don't see it. You only see the rest of the particles, but you see that the remaining particles seem to violate momentum conservation. And momentum conservation in this view is hard to determine because, see, there's no detector along the beam pipe, so most of the stuff just flies in, still in the beam pipe and is not detected. But if you view the detector head-on, so now this is, again, looking along the beam pipe, you see that here is stuff going, here is stuff going, and here is stuff going, but everything is a little bit more to the right than to the left. There's nothing to the left, and both of them are to the right. So since the beam has no momentum transverse to the beam, this means in this collision, there must have been something that went this way with lots of energy to balance the tendency of all the rest to go to the right. So this means here, some particle has been created that we don't see. And this is what supersymmetry would look like. You would see an imbalance of energy. So this is what this is the thing we are looking for. And there are some other more subtle effects that also indicate supersymmetry. And our expectation for LHC was, I remember a couple of years ago, before the LHC was turned on, I heard talks that said, oh, within actually 5 minutes, if not, then in a week, we discover supersymmetry. That was the expectation of particle physicists for the LHC. But when it was actually turned on and actually was going, even the Fuhrer had to learn that we have not seen any direct evidence for supersymmetry at LHC, although we expected to see it there. So, in a more technical way, this is actual picture from publication from this one from the CMS detector. This is what they publish about supersymmetry. These are bounds that you're supposed to read like this. This is a mass scale, an energy scale, and these are all types of different supersymmetric partner particles that, and also different processes in which they would have been created. And you're supposed to read this as, if superpartners exist, they have to be heavier than blah in order that we wouldn't have seen them so far. So all these are so-called mass bounds. So you see that the superpartners would have to be heavier, well, depending on the type and the process, than these numbers. And I explained in the beginning that we would have expected them at 100 GeV, which is here. So there's obviously a problem. So now what? As you know, there are known unknowns and unknown unknowns, as this famous philosopher explained. So what can we do? So I mean, the easy way to wiggle out is to say, oh, there's still room in the parameter space. We can tune some of the 120 parameters in such a way that are compatible with the bounds that we obtained from the experiments. The other possibility is to say, well, maybe this was only the simplest version. I said this is the minimal supersymmetric version. We can also come up with extra stuff, even more particles. And in these more contrived models, again, there's even more wiggling room to say, well, this could explain why we haven't seen it so far. But of course, these more complicated models are more baroque and even harder to, well, motivate. Or simply, the 100 GeV scale supersymmetry that would have explained naturalness is not nature's solution to naturalness. And, but then, so do we have to forget Susie? Well, maybe. But if Susie is not realized in nature, and these solutions to look for some other regions, parameter space, this would mean we'd have to come up with new solutions to these five problems that Susie is actually solving for us. And I have to say, not any good alternative candidate here is known. There are some for naturalness, but they have even weaker phenomenological bases than supersymmetry. So my take-home message is, I try to explain that supersymmetry offers solutions to some of the most pressing open questions in particle physics, but unfortunately, it's not as easy as we had hoped. We haven't seen it, although we expected it, but there's hope for the next round of LHC. Currently, LHC is not running. It's, well, people put in more stuff to make it run at even higher energies and higher collision rates. So we hope that within version 2 of LHC, more collisions at higher energy, that those reveal supersymmetry. And if not, then we have to come up with other ideas. So thanks a lot.
So we have about 10 minutes here for questions. If you have any questions, if you can use the two microphones in the two aisles, and here we go. Form two neat lines, and we'll start with this gentleman here, and then work one, two.
So you said that the WIMP candidates would have to interact weakly as well.
Well, at most weekly.
At most weekly, yes. So it's possible that they would not partake in the weak interaction, because I was thinking that you have some events in the universe which are very extreme manifestations of the weak interactions, like supernovae, where you get an enormous number of neutrinos and enormous densities of neutrinos, and if we should not expect some sort of effect between WIMPs and neutrinos from a supernova, which would be observable.
Well, they have to partake in some interaction, otherwise we could never create those particles. So that's the first thing. And then you're mixing things up. So indeed, a supernova is a very big energy concept. But when I said these are high energies, even this 10 to the 19 GeV Planck scale, this as a mass from everyday scale, that's microgram mass. So, I mean, me doing this is a much higher energy process than any Planck scale process. The problem is, when I do this, I'm not a single particle, but I consist of 10 to the 23 particles, and they share this energy. And again, a supernova, I mean, there's a whole star exploding. So yes, it has much, much higher energy, but distributed amongst all the particles that make up the star. So yes and no.
Thanks.
This gentleman over here. Yeah.
Okay. My question is, if there are such particles which do not interact electromagnetically with other parts but have mass, shouldn't they concentrate in the center of a galaxy and change again the rotation a little bit?
No, because of momentum conservation, they just fly. I mean, they only feel the mass. They just fly around on big orbits. Nothing kind of, there's no friction that makes them fall into. So let me go back to my picture of the galaxy. No? Ah, back. Ah, here's my picture of a galaxy. The fact that the galaxy is a disk comes actually from the friction. So it starts out, I mean, early in cosmic evolution, there was just stuff flying around. So it was more or less a bulb, three-dimensional thing. But then it has rotation. So it has angular momentum. And because the stars, they actually feel each other. I mean, the stars, I mean, they interact gravitationally, and they're heavy enough to have significant gravitational force. This complicated gravitational pull of all the millions of stars amongst them that acts like friction. And that this friction makes this three-dimensional bulb kind of decay and fall back. And the fact that there's angular momentum that has to be conserved, that cannot be radiated off, makes it actually go into a disk, because the disk is the configuration with the given angular momentum with the kind of lowest energy. So if they don't interact, they don't do this, they don't have the friction, they would just fly around in orbits like this.
So you say gravity is not enough to build those concentrations?
No, because these are, again, single particles. I mean, they're tiny, tiny particles. These are stars. Stars have significant gravity, but these particles.
Okay, and shouldn't those supersymmetric particles have effect to the Hawking's radiation? If they constantly, so if you have it in the
Hawking radiation?
Hawking radiation.
It sounds like this particular question needs to be taken outside.
The answer is no Hawking radiation.
This is brilliant. You remind me of my old physics tutor at university. No, you're wrong. We'll take a question here from the rear queue here. Is that microphone on?
Hello?
No, there's...
Okay. No. Do you just want to come forward to this mic?
No, it works.
Oh,
it works. Okay, I always thought the advantage of the LHC is that we accelerate protons. And now you say, well, a proton is three quarks and a bag of dust, and the actual collision takes place between only a small part of them. So why didn't you stay with the electrons in the first place and accumulate all the energy to this one lepton?
Well, that was my first point that was encoded in my answer. They're easy to accelerate.
Well, the electrons... So
you cannot... the problem is you want to accelerate them in a ring, and the fact that... So people did that with electrons in the past. The predecessor, LEP, did this with electrons. But the electrons, when you put them on a circular orbit, they radiate off electromagnetic waves. They lose energy also when you pull them on the ring, and they lose more energy than you pump in by the acceleration. So if you want to accelerate electrons at these high energies, you cannot do this in a ring. You have to do this in a straight accelerator, linear accelerator. And actually, the next thing that physicists would like to build is such a linear accelerator. That would be like 30-kilometer pipes, straight pipes, colliding. Actually, there was a proposal to build one here at DESY, so that would have reached from Pinneberg or Elmshorn to the DESY area in Barnfeld, and then another 15 kilometers in the other direction.
Not small. This gentleman here.
Yeah, in the diagram that is just like next slide.
This one.
You just show like an interaction with like a supersymmetric particle, and you see that there is like a neutrino like ejected on the top.
Yeah.
But couldn't we like see those neutrinos or like detect them somehow?
No, we don't see them as well.
Okay, so they are never been seen or like.
Not in such a particle detector. There are detectors for neutrinos, but they're completely of different.
Yeah, I know. But we could like have like somewhere in Earth, and we could like see them coming from like those points in the galaxy or somehow, like seeing an excess of neutrino. Or...
Yeah, but remember, you're creating just one.
Yeah.
Compared to like the sun.
Are difficult enough to detect.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're just about out of time here. Do we have any questions from the internet? No, okay.
Maybe this lady in the back.
Yeah, okay. We'll take one more here for this lady here and then call it quitsies.
Okay, I have no clue, and I try to get a basic understanding of this dark matter concept. So as I understood it, there should be mass, but there is nothing that emits anything that we could measure. Is that right?
Well, that we see. I mean, we just see light. So we only see stuff that emits light, namely stars.
Okay, what is light? Or is that too complicated?
Light.
Sorry.
Light. I mean, when you look at go outside, no clouds, stars. You see the light from the stars. That's what we see. I mean, that's our information about the galaxy. It's the light from the stars that reaches us. And this comes from stars, and we know what stars are made out of.
Okay, so it's only light.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. Was that? Do you feel appropriately enlightened?
Yeah. Come to me afterwards, and maybe I can give you a longer version of the sentence.
Okay. Well, this. If there are any further questions, Dr. Helen will cheerfully take your questions in the lounge. Is that a good place to do it?
No, that's too loud. Okay, just that's too loud. The door.
All right, just out that door. This probably also neatly explains why I failed QM when I tried it for my undergrad about 20-something-odd years ago. That's embarrassing. Thank you very much, Dr. Helling. Big round of applause, please.